My premise to you today is that cellulosic ethanol is a lot nearer than most people think. And because that's the case, we have the opportunity actually to shape this future of biofuels that's coming at us. I gave a similar talk, a longer version of this, last week at University of Wisconsin, and Mike Kassler afterwards said, "You didn't convince me." So I put up front here why it's closer, and I'll be able to go into detail on some of these, but not all of them. It's closer because there's an awful lot of plant material out there available for conversion. Yes, there could be more. We'll need to think about how to do it sustainably. Yes, yes, and yes. But the fact is there's a lot of plant material available for conversion, and we could grow a lot more. In fact, I'd love to see you folks challenged to do that. In fact, you're going to be challenged to do it. The key part for me as an engineer is that plant matter's energy content is a lot less expensive than oil's energy content. Of course, the trick is that a bale of switchgrass doesn't fit real conveniently in your engine, your gas tank. And so the question is how we can efficiently convert the energy content of plant material into something that will serve as a fuel. The technology to convert biomass energy content to liquid fuels is improving. There's actually a lot of work that's already been done by myself and a few other foolhardy people over the years. But federal and state research support is at least $1 billion that I've been able to count up. Venture capital, other private funds, at least another $1 billion, probably more than that. And large-scale plants being built at the tune of $500 million right now. So there's money going into this research and commercialization that has never gone into it before. And the reason it's all guided by the fact that, again, oil's high. That's the key reason. The infrastructure for using and distributing ethanol is improving. More vehicles that are compatible, more E85 gas pumps, on and on and on. The macro trends, the larger trends for oil are negative, while the trends for biomass ethanol and other biofuels, but I'm going to emphasize ethanol, are largely positive. In other words, oil's heading the wrong direction and biofuels are heading the right direction. Okay. There's finally the political will to make this happen. I've been closely plugged into this for a long time. Finally, both political parties, this is a high priority item, and it doesn't seem like that's going away. The externalities of oil and all those non-monetary costs are finally coming home to roost. And I would emphasize there's lots of money to be made here with oil at $100 a barrel and thereabouts. And that's a huge driving force. Shouldn't underestimate it. So that's my answer to Mike. Okay, and now here's some more details for the rest of you. All commodity products, this is speaking of my background as a chemical engineer, whether it's a fuel, a bulk chemical, semiconductor chips, or potato chips, only two things matter in the cost of production. One is the cost of the raw material or the feedstock, and the other is cost of processing the raw material to the desired products. Okay, so here's the key, this is a key issue, and here's the key slide of all things that ought to matter to you. I started working this field in about 1976, my doctoral studies. For most of the remaining, 25, 30 years, oil prices were in this neighborhood of $15 to $20 a barrel. No alternative to oil, not one, made any sense during that, any economic sense. They made great environmental sense, they made great national security sense, but they were not sustainable economically. We are not in those days anymore. We're not in Kansas anymore, or wherever it is that we're not, okay? Oil has entered a new trading range, and the other day it was trading close to $100 a barrel. That is why this is going to happen quicker than anybody thinks, because there's a huge unsatisfied demand out there for low-cost liquid fuels, okay? And that's freeing up all kinds of scientific talent, all kinds of money to make this happen. This number, actually, of $15 to $20 a barrel turns out to be kind of interesting because of the next slide. If you could believe that you can get together quite a bit of plant material for $50 a dry ton delivered, let's say within some radius, 20 miles or so, the energy content of cellulosic biomass at that $50 a ton is roughly equal to the energy content of oil at $15 a barrel, which is where we were trading for 30 years. Okay, so in other words, what I was doing was hopeless and stupid, or whatever you want to say about it. But fortunately, society pays these universities to keep around some really stubborn, bullheaded people so that they can work on stuff that may over time actually prove out to be worthwhile. I didn't know whether I was going to die or retire before this happened, but I was convinced, based on other things I know about, that it was going to happen. So when oil's $15 a barrel, you can buy the plant material energy, but you can't convert it into anything. You can't afford to convert it into anything. Now we have this margin here between $15 a barrel oil and wherever it is from there on up to process the oil into products. This is why cellulosic ethanol is much nearer than you think. The Brazilians have already reduced the cost of ethanol from sugarcane, and that's a much less technology-intensive process, but we can, and I believe will do the same thing. It costs less to make ethanol now from sugarcane in Brazil than it does to than the energy content of gasoline. This is on equal energy basis. And so this is going to happen. So processing improvements are really what this is all about right now. In a relatively short period of time, but that's a talk for another day or maybe next year's convention here. But we need to figure out how to reduce processing costs. The cost of the raw material, again, the feedstock cost, remember only two things matter, cost of feedstock and cost of processing. The biomass costs are going to be stable or maybe even decline somewhat. The processing costs are dominated by pretreatment, by the enzymes, and by fermentation. In all those, we've actually made some advances in those years where not many people were paying attention. And those advances are being incorporated in this first generation of cellulosic ethanol plants. The processing costs are going to come down. Okay, they will decrease. There's two primary ways to do this. One is learning by doing in large-scale plants. There's some kinds of cost reductions you just can't get until you start doing things at a very large scale in a real facility. We know this from our experience with oil handling, with corn grain processing by a wet milling, on and on. And the other is by focusing your research on those aspects of the overall system that are most cost intensive, okay? And we're also starting to do that. I believe that's a lot more attractive future. Domestically produced fuels, environmental improvements are possible if we make them so, and the opportunity for rural and regional economic development. I can't speak in any detail about these today. I want to mention just briefly some environmental improvements that we think are possible. Okay, I said two primary ways of getting costs down. One is to do large-scale processing, and the other is to focus your research on cost-intensive areas. Last spring, the Department of Energy announced financial incentives for the first six large-scale cellulosic ethanol plants. These are using different technologies, different raw materials, different parts of the country. Basically, DOE said, we're going to bet on one of everything. Okay, we're going to try one of everything. Looks like, to me, is what they've chosen here. I'll speak briefly about what we call the AFEX pretreatment technology. That's a technology that I invented and been working on. It's being considered for testing in the Broin Poet plant in Iowa. But the point is, large-scale processing facilities. Since then, Mascoma Corporation, which is one of the leaders in this space, has announced, without federal support, a large-scale 40 million gallon a year cellulosic ethanol plant in Michigan. See, the money is coming into this, and these are venture capital people. They have lots of money, but they're really smart, and they've made their bets. They believe this is going to happen. Briefly, I told you that the costs are dominated by three areas: pretreatment, cost of enzymes, and cost of fermentation. Let me cover just real briefly to illustrate how you get costs down, talking about pretreatment. It's relatively easy to convert very easy to convert the sugars in sugarcane to ethanol. Okay, they're just available, just squeeze them out and ferment them. For starch, it's a little bit more difficult. Heat up the starch, add the enzymes, generate the sugars. For cellulosic materials, it's considerably more difficult. Mother Nature designed plant cell walls so they didn't break down easily. So you have to trick Mother Nature, you have to fool her by doing things that she didn't anticipate. But there's a whole variety of, or didn't evolve to protections for. There's a whole variety of chemical and physical protections that are built into plant cell walls that prevent you get from getting high sugar yields. In a well-developed, mature industry, the cost of the raw material will represent 70% of the overall cost to produce. Right now, that fraction is reversed. Plant material cost is about 30% of the cost to produce, and all the rest of the system, all the rest of the costs, are in the processing. Specifically, pretreatment and condition is the single most important processing operation. Okay, let me give you a crash course in chemical engineering. This is Chemical Engineering Economics 101, one semester in a hurry. There are four factors that matter in the cost of producing a commodity product in a chemical plant or chemical engineering environment. There's scale, how big your operation is, how many tons a year you produce. Yield, which is the tons of product produced per ton of your major raw materials. There's reaction rate, how fast are you producing it, basically kilograms of product per liter of reactor volume per time. And concentration, which is volume of product produced per, or mass of product produced per volume of the reactor system. And what I've represented here is the major cost elements in each of these. So this is the factor in increasing for raw materials, for utilities, and capital costs. These are all the different costs that are involved. Scale has a large effect on capital costs, but not much on utility or raw materials. Yield, however, has a strong positive effect on raw material costs. The higher your yield, the lower the raw material cost per unit of product. The higher the yield, the lower the utility cost. Less stuff to heat, less stuff to stir. The higher the yield, the stronger, the greater the less the capital cost per unit of product. Reaction rate and concentration matter also. Concentration more important than reaction rate. But the biggest of all is yield. Okay, most important of all is yield. How much product do you get per ton of stuff that you buy? Okay, so consider that in the context of a biological processing of plant materials. You produce the plant material, which is you folks, bailiwick plus the harvesting and storage, then it's delivered to the first step in the biorefiner, which is the pretreatment. Pretreatment is necessary to increase the yield. Without pretreatment, an effective pretreatment, you don't get adequate yields for economic viability. And in fact, pretreatment has more influences than that. Pretreatment also determines what plant material you can use. It influences the yield of enzymes, or the enzymes that are required to generate the sugars, whether or not any conditioning of the sugars are required, because the pretreatments can generate toxic or inhibitory materials, on and on and on. Arguably, it's the single most impactful process in the whole system, because it determines yield, concentration, and rate of everything thereafter. Okay. So we use a process we call ammonia fiber expansion as a pretreatment. We heat biomass with hot concentrated ammonia, about 100 degrees C, boiling temperature of water, concentrated 60 or 70% or so ammonia in water mixtures. Pressure release, this is under pressure, so a rapid pressure release allows the ammonia to evaporate, ends the treatment. The ammonia is recovered and can be reutilized again. The ammonia serves as a nitrogen source downstream. We generate little or if any fermentation inhibitors, which is a contrast to the acid sorts of treatments. It's a dry-to-dry process. This is corn stover before treatment. Afterwards, it's slightly darker, but this is just you allow the ammonia to evaporate, and this is what the material looks like. So it's a solid, dry material going in. It's a solid, dry material coming out of the process. Physically, it doesn't seem to be changed very much, but chemically and internally, there's a lot of changes. Now, I'm not going to go into those, but without treatment, you get a maximum of about 30% of the total cellulose converted to sugars. After treatment, same enzyme dosage, nearly 100% conversion of glucan to sugars. We can do the same thing with xylan by playing with the hemicellulose fractions, but the point is, this is the yield difference. Again, yield is number one. Okay, concentration is also much higher. Again, this is aphex-treated corn stover in a fed-batch fermentation. This is 24% solids. So there's 240 grams of solids per liter of solution. In fermentation and hydrolysis system here, you get a liquid within just a couple of hours. Okay, it's been liquefied. Untreated stover, on the other hand, 24% solids, is essentially what it looks like going in. There's nothing happens to it. This material flows very easily. This doesn't flow worth a dang. Okay. But we have very concentrated sugars here, and hardly any concentration of sugars at this point. Yield, concentration, and rate. Okay, this rate is obviously much higher. So it impacts and improves the confidence of all of those. Three years ago, Tim Eggemann at the National Renewable Energy Lab did an independent economic analysis of a variety of pretreatments. This shows the minimum ethanol selling price as a function of the pretreatment that's used. These numbers here aren't very important, really, because they have a lot of assumptions built in. What is important is that for the first time, we had a good economic analysis. This field has been underfunded for quite a while. We had a good economic analysis of where the costs were in our aphex system. So this is what he estimated at $1.41 a gallon. Tim's economic analysis said, to get the cost down, reduce the amount of ammonia that you use. Reduce the required ammonia concentration in the recycle stream, basically manage system water. Reduce the capital cost of the aphex process. Okay. So my students and I went about to do that. And the original estimate was $1.41 a gallon. We figured out how, by managing the headspace of the system and also the way you combine ammonia, water, and biomass to reduce the required concentration of ammonia in the recycle stream. Same economic analysis, again with new parameters, takes off about 20 cents a gallon. Then we figured out a new ammonia recovery approach that did not use compressors like our first approach did, but used chilled water to recover the ammonia. Approximately another 20 cent a gallon estimate in the drop in the processing cost. We're still working to drive down processing costs. We're now working with people who are doing what's called consolidated bioprocessing, or CBP. CBP is a system in which a single microorganism produces the enzymes, and then the organism produces the enzymes that generate the sugars, and then ferments those sugars directly. So that's a consolidated bioprocessing organism. The economics indicate that we should be able to produce ethanol for about 80 cents a gallon when we have those organisms developed and integrated with AFEX. Ultimately, where we want to get is the same degree of technical maturity that we have in the oil refining industry today, which is 70% feedstock cost and about 30% processing cost. You do that by scale, by a variety of other kinds of innovations. I'm fully confident that we're going to get there, and again, much more quickly than people realize. There's going to be a special issue coming out of biomass and bioenergy that shows all the papers that support the data that I've just shown you. But I just want to point out that the estimated costs of making ethanol on various types of process, this is using AFEX as a treatment, are in the neighborhood here of 60 cents per gallon. Okay, on an energy equivalent basis with gasoline, that's around $1 a gallon gasoline equivalent. Biofuels, cellulosic ethanol, is going to be a lot cheaper than gasoline is going to be. Again, that reality hasn't sunk in yet, but I believe it will over the next few years. Where I want to spend now the rest of my time with you, one of the most attractive ways of producing ethanol, economically attractive, is to co-produce an animal feed protein with the ethanol. We spent a lot of time working on this. It gives you the cheapest ethanol of all, okay, about 50 cents per gallon. Okay, just accept for a moment with me, or suspend disbelief, if you will, that we are going to get to really inexpensive ethanol. If that happens, then we really have a significant change in the world. Much less the influence of petroleum on the prosperity and the politics of the world, less chance for a resource-driven conflict, and so on. Lots of greater economic growth opportunities for poor nations. Also, if we're smart, if we choose to do, if we think about it ahead of time, we can improve the environment. We can build in opportunities for rural economic development and less expensive food or animal feed is possible. I'm only going to briefly discuss this one next year. Perhaps next year or another time come back and talk to you in more detail about what we're doing in this area. But I want to talk briefly about environmental improvements. We think about this as a whole system where you have the crops are produced, they are biorefined, ethanol and other products. Some fractions of the plant material are recycled, probably the protein, in an associated animal feeding operation. So we're integrating food or feed and fuel production. We draw the system boundaries and then do a life cycle analysis using the recognized life cycle tools to look at what the environmental impacts are. We use a model, DASENT, many of you are aware of it. This is we haven't developed the model, obviously other people did that, but to simulate soil organic carbon and nitrogen dynamics under a variety of cropping management practices, looking at carbon profiles, N2O emissions from the soil, and nitrate leaching. Again, many of you are acquainted with this diagram, just shows the flows between the different pools of carbon as they're affected by genetic potential, nutrients, moisture, and so forth. Okay, so we use this tool, and this is my last two or three slides here, and hope we can have a good lively discussion. Again, I said environmental improvements were possible in cellulosic ethanol if we chose to do that, if we were wise and looked ahead. There's a lot of desire to harvest corn stover to make a cellulosic ethanol and to improve farmer profits. It'd be an additional feedstock for cellulosic ethanol and could improve farmer profits. However, and you folks know this better than I, corn stover removal tends to reduce soil organic matter and it tends to increase soil erosion. That's not the right direction. I don't accept that as a good direction for us to head. So the question I've asked myself and our group is, Is there a solution to this that allows us to remove Stover sustainably? It would be great to have that Stover, but not at the expense of soil health. Okay. The approach that we're looking at, that I'm going to show you briefly the models, is to use a winter cover crop. Again, you know this a lot better than I do, but you plant a cool season grass after the corn harvest or after the silage harvest. It grows rapidly in the spring, takes up excess soil nitrogen and phosphorus, you know that, and builds up soil organic matter. The results I'm going to show you is to kill or plow under the cover crop before planting the next corn crop, or harvest the cover crop. We're now studying this option to see what it does to us, for us in terms of environmental impacts. But again, if you're looking at collecting the maximum amount of solar energy and tying up nutrients, then this cover crop, this is about a mile south of my house, early May, a couple of years ago, this picture is a lot better than this picture. Okay. Again, if you want to protect soil quality, if you want to collect the maximum solar energy to convert to a biofuel, that's a lot more attractive picture than that. Same day, 180 degrees, adjacent field. Okay, so what we did was to simulate, using the Descent model, the basic cropping system, which is corn and soybean, and then plant look at a cover crop under no-till continuous corn, where we remove different amounts of the Stover. Different amounts of Stover for biofuel production. And then the winter cover crop on a no-till corn and soybean rotation. Again, what happens if you remove Stover? I realize these are simulations, but they seem to bear out what people see in experience. And this is what the model tells us. This is for Fulton County, Illinois. So you do it on specific locations. For corn-soy rotation, the soil organic matter is roughly constant over time. And what I want to skip to here is you can remove 70% of the Stover if you plant a cover crop on continuous corn, and you still get large improvements in soil organic matter. Again, this meets the test of credulity. These cover crops have got a lot of root mass that they leave behind after you kill or harvest the top. So soil organic matter should increase. And the next thing we looked at was what happens to nitrogen losses. Well, again, I don't think I'm going to tell you anything that you're going to automatically suspect, but the size of the reduction was really interesting to us. Because you have plant matter on the soil longer, you tie up nitrogen and other nutrients that would otherwise escape to the groundwater or to other water bodies. Continuous cover crop, just removing the grain, continuous corn crop, just removing the grain. Compare continuous corn removing 70% of the Stover, but with a winter wheat cover crop. You get a 5 to 10-fold reduction in the inorganic nitrogen loss. Okay? A huge drop in nitrogen losses. Okay? So if you're going to remove Stover at all, it needs to be done in a way that's environmentally sustainable. I think this is one option. There may be others, but it seems to me this is one that's an option. Okay, to end here, I believe ethanol is going to be a lot cheaper and happen a lot faster than most people realize. I think we're going to see that unfolding over the next 5 years. Since that's going to happen, I'm assuming that, there are environmental improvements that can be made if we make it so. There's rural economic development that's possible if we choose to make it so, if we think wisely and ahead of time. This future is ours to create. I've never believed that the future is something that just happens to you. I believe that we have, as thinking beings, the opportunity to change or to design the kind of future we want to live in. So I'm looking forward to addressing questions now. Thanks very much. And you'll take it easy on a poor, humble chemical engineer, won't you? No chance, is what I heard. Mike, do you want to call on people, Kurt? I don't want to get in trouble by... It was the killing of the cover crop. It was sprayed with an herbicide and plowed under. Yeah.
You seem to presuppose ethanol as the major product. What about other products like butanol?
Yeah, if butanol can meet the same tests of yield, concentration, and rate as ethanol, then I think it's fine. I think there's a lot of hype about butanol. Right now at the point, all the data that I've seen that have been released publicly, butanol's concentrations are around 1.5%, where ethanol's are upwards of 15%, and the rate of production is actually quite a bit slower. But if they can overcome technical hurdles, it's a better, it's easier fuel to transport for sure.
Are you involved with the power plant in Edmonton, Iowa?
No.
But you're APEC process.
I know, but
the process
is APEC, but the process that we invented was called APEC, ammonia fiber expansion. Oh no, there's lots of pre-treatments. Acid, base, solvent
that
extraction.
Plant, okay. That plant, is that
the Iowa plant is actually considering, the Iowa brine plant or pellet plant is actually considering two, as I understand it, two pre-treatments. One is an ammonia pre-treatment by DuPont, and the other is our APEC pre-treatment. What plant?
Yes, what plants are we planning to use?
Okay. The question is what plant raw materials are being considered for use in this country for biofuel production? Basically, all biomass is local. It will be whatever is most appropriate for that particular area. Some places wheat straw, places corn stover. Switchgrass is a very attractive one. I'm not 100% sold on miscanthus yet, although the per acre yields are pretty impressive. So there's a lot of them.
Yeah,
for a chemical engineer, frankly, I don't care. What I want is a high yield of a sustainably produced plant material delivered to the biorefinery. Okay, it has to be convertible, but after that, I don't care what's grown. I'm sorry, you've had two questions now. Maybe somebody else.
No question.
Okay. Okay, the question is about biodiesel and why Germany and Canada seem to have chosen biodiesel. Ethanol is a defined chemical product. Biodiesel is not. Okay, and it matters a very great deal how you generate the biodiesel. Okay, I'll be very frank with people here. Biodiesel produced from virgin soy oil is one of the dumbest ideas out there. Okay, it's simply too costly. The soybean oil is too high a cost. You're making biodiesel from recycled yellow grease or so forth. They have no objection. But I have a hard time seeing how biodiesel from most temperate zone oilseed crops is ever going to make economic sense. Obviously the political element here is strong. I guess that's about all I can say there. You sound like an authentic Canadian, so okay, let's go.
My other question is, what kind of uniformity in your feedstock do you require? And as your scale goes up, does not your cost of your processing material increase because you have to source from a farther distance?
Yeah, there is a trade-off here between cost of transportation and scale of operation, and those numbers are known pretty well. There's still, though, at what we think of reasonable harvest transports, it still pays you to get to a larger plant. Uniformity of product is an important issue, and supply, the whole logistics area, which was, I think, neglected, weren't even more neglected than the pretreatment and other research, is finally taking the kind of attention that it deserves. So, yeah, getting large volumes of material harvested and delivered is really crucial.